Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, welcome to The Real Deal. I'm Joshua Blakeney, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Ole Damagard. Ole has an encyclopedic mind and is one of the world's leading experts on false flag terrorism and covert operations, especially assassinations. So he's in good company with us. Ole began critically analysing the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, who was a social democratic leader of Sweden from 1969 to 1976. And as the layers of the onion peeled away, Ole came to the scary realization that many global assassinations and covered-up incidents are actually interwoven with one another due to the fact that those executing, quite literally, the assassinations are often working for the same people. This led him into an analysis of Operation 40, for example, of which much more later. So welcome to the show, Ole. How are you doing today?
I'm doing absolutely super. Thank you.
So you're one of these people who I'd sort of like to meet at a party because I could sort of come up to you and ask you a question about anything and everything, and you sort of seem to be an expert on it. I heard you recently do interviews pertaining to the assassinations of pop stars such as Bob Marley, such as Paul McCartney, such as John Lennon. Obviously, Paul McCartney, it's more tentative referring to the assassination of Paul McCartney because most people think he's alive today. But there is a theory that I have recently looked into myself that he actually died and was replaced by a double. Do you think there's any truth to that theory?
I normally try to avoid that one because it normally sounds way too far out there. But I tell you, I've been contacting quite a few plastic surgeons and so on, and they say when they compare the facial measurements and so on with the person now who claims to be Paul McCartney and the one before 1966, that it's absolutely not the same person. So then the big question comes, why on earth would they do a thing like this? Why would they exchange him and so on? And I think when you mention assassination, this is something I don't agree on. It was an accident. And after that, he was replaced with this other guy. But like I say, this is one I normally try to avoid because I don't want to go into the tinfoil hat corner straight away. I prefer sticking to things that I really know about.
But more generally, it's fair to say that the Beatles appear to have been created, manufactured, to serve a certain political agenda. And this relates to the Tavistock Institute, doesn't it?
This is the way the evidence is pointing, and it's like once again there's more than one former MI6 agent who have stepped forward and have been explaining a lot about how this whole thing was created, and that these Beatles songs and so on was not even written by these guys, but that they were a created band, and that the whole idea was to destabilize society and invite in more drugs and this whole thing. And when you see what happened from the year 1963 when they came with She Loves You, Yeah, 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 till only 5-6 years later when they broke up, when it was all, flower power and drugs and all of this, they really had a massive impact on the whole world it's up to everybody to make their own opinion, but I mean, it went from a very strict society into a very, very loose and open society with lots of drugs and experiments and so on. So there's a lot of proof showing that way. And also it's important to remember that in this group, this band, there were four people, and Paul McCartney, it seems like he was killed in this accident in 1966 and replaced by a double, which is normally referred to as Fall, not Paul. And if you listen to many of the interviews with George Harrison and John as well, they refer to this guy as Fall. They don't say Paul, they say Fall. And like I say, these facial structures, like you can change the shape of the nose, you can change all type of things, you can change the angles of the teeth and so on. But the width between the eyes and also the size of the skull and the height, these are things that you cannot change, and they don't match up at all. Even the eye color is different as well. So, well, it's up to each and one of you to make up your own opinion, or I would suggest to look into this if you're interested. But also that this could be connected to the time of the assassination of John Lennon, because he was just about, this is at least the official or unofficial story, that he was just about to go official with this story, to tell this what this whole thing had been about, with this fake thing and fake thing about the Beatles. And that was just a few weeks before, I think 10 days before he was assassinated. And then when George, he knew about it, and he knew that John was trying to do this, and when he was thinking about stepping forward, he too was attacked in his home and stabbed several times and almost died. And so there's a violent history around this group.
Yes, yes. And you can imagine popularizing drugs, for example, would have served the interests of Western intelligence agencies who, during that epoch, at the time of the Cold War, were fearful that young people would become class conscious, would become politically aware, would try to emulate the better aspects of the socialist world, you know, really challenge the capitalists. And so, you know, I've read a book by a journalist named Peter Hitchens, who's the brother of the neocon journalist, Christopher Hitchens, and he's sort of someone who's a non-neoconservative, and he's written a book about how drugs became popularized in the UK. And actually, it was Brian Epstein, who was the manager of the Beatles, who instigated the popularization of, like, marijuana and other drugs in the United Kingdom. And it does seem that the Beatles and other bands, you know, that kind of hippie mentality of, you know, drug, sex, rock and roll, and dropping out rather than engaging with politics, that did serve an agenda. And so when I hear theories that, you know, people like John Lennon, perhaps they were deviating from their prescribed role of serving the interests of those in power to becoming a critic of those in power, you know, when I hear theories about that it was an inside job, that was a covert operation to assassinate Lennon and perhaps other members of the Beatles, I think that there's a lot of truth to that, probably.
I can only say that I'm, over all of these years, I had to focus on one thing, because if you go into the world of conspiracies, it's such a massive arena, and with so many multi-layered it's so multi-layered, so it's so much to take in and so much to learn about. So I decided on an early stage to focus on sort of the street level. So what I've been focusing on is trying to reveal who actually carried out the assassinations, who were the assassins, who paid them, how did they get in and out of the crime scene, how was it covered up, and how was it the fake investigations put together, and so on. So I'm the wrong person to ask about question when it gets to a higher level, like up in the Illuminati and all of these areas that I leave to other people. But I can only say when it comes to John Lennon, in this interview, I would very much like to explain a little about one group of assassins that was put together in the late 1950s and early 1960s, a group called Operation 40, which was it was a group created by President Dwight Eisenhower, who had his vice president, Richard Nixon. He was given the task to get this sort of very violent task force together as a weapon that could be used to take out other foreign leaders or whoever they had problems with, both in the U.S. especially. And the man that they put as a paymaster, the guy who got the money in to finance this whole thing, was a young man by the name of George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush Sr. He was the guy who was financing this whole thing, not from his own pocket, but from the military-industrial complex, the major big companies that have been thrown out from Cuba, the oil tycoons in Texas, and so on. And this group was put together with mostly exiled Cuban, former military people from the Air Force, from the military, from the police, from the Batista regime before Fidel Castro. And these exiled Cubans were also joined by high-ranking CIA officers. Some of them was, I can mention, E. Howard Hunt, who was later very central in the Watergate burglary. He was also very central in the JFK assassination and many, 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 many other operation. There was Ted Shackley, who was also, he is so central in, I mean, hundreds of operations all over the world. And there was a man by the name of David Attlee Phillips, who was later the chief of the CIA for the Western Hemisphere. I mean, we are talking CIA people, but on a super high level. And these people were in this group with these assassins. And to start with, this group was aimed to take out Fidel Castro, which they tried several times. But then when they started, the global elite started having problems with John F. Kennedy, that he would, to start with, they controlled him and he was their guy more or less without really knowing it. But then after the Cuban Missile Crisis, he had like a, I think like a revelation when he was almost pushed into starting the Third World War. And he just said, I refuse to be the one who started this. So after that point, he became a person who suddenly, I would say, woke up to see the madness that was being created and how it would destroy the world if somebody didn't wake up and do something about it. And from that point on, he became somebody they could not trust at all. He went for the Federal Reserve. He wanted to print money that was not controlled by this banking elite. He wanted to withdraw out of Vietnam, which wasn't even a war that had started, had really begun on the American part. He wanted to crush the CIA in 1,000 pieces. He went for the mob. He sent his brother to take them out and so on. So he was creating massive waves of shock in the secret world of the mob and these secret services and so on. And in the assassination of JFK, they used many of the people involved in the assassination was directly connected and part of this Operation 40. And the people in this group was also, I can name all of them, I can go into much more detail if you want, but one of them was a man called José Perdomo. He was the highest ranking officer by within the exiled Cuban part of it for about 10 years. And the evening when John Lennon was killed, you had Mark Chapman was there. Mark Chapman is the one that was sentenced for the assassination later, but I would suggest that he was like a maturing candidate. Quite a few of these big assassins have people that have, the people who have been taken down for these crimes have been under some sort of mind control. And this guy is a typical example of such a person, somebody weak mentally and who has been put through a lot of horrible experiences and so on to split up the personality into more than one, and also being able to control them with hypnotism and other very heavy methods like coming from the MK Ultra and so on. But on the evening when John Lennon was assassinated, it's very important to understand that he was just on his way to make a massive comeback after a lot of years being out of the focus for most people. He had just released his new album, and they were planning like a peace tour where they were going to go all over the place and really promote peace. And peace is one of these things that this global elite have had always. That is the major problem with them, for them, because their agenda is death and destruction. That is where they make their billions, where their whole game, the global is in place. So peace is the last thing they want. And many of these people who have been taking out over the years have been people who have been standing up for these beautiful virtues like peace and truthfulness and all of these things that Mahatma Gandhi, for instance, was a symbol for, and Martin Luther King. Lady Diana and John Lennon, and so Bob Marley as well. And anyway, when the limo came to park outside, it was in the evening. It was more or less exactly a year ago. No, but on this time of year. And when they came, they parked, and Yoko Ono left the limo first and started walking into the building, the Dakota building where they were living. And Mark Chapman was standing to the right. John Lennon went out and passed him, and what happened afterwards was that just a few steps further into was the building, there were four or five shots fired, and John Lennon went down, he was mostly wounded, and started crawling into the building where he fell together, and then later he was taken to the hospital and declared dead. But the thing is, when you look at the crime scene, if you look at the gun wounds, the bullet holes, all of the bullets hit Lennon straight from the left, and Mark Chapman was standing to the right. So a very good question would be, who was standing to the left? And at this specific night, the doorman was this man called Jose Perdomo. At that time, he was a nice-looking gentleman in his late 60s or so. But we have this one of the highest or the most skilled assassins of all times in America, who was the doorman at this very night, the one that at a spot where the shots were fired, and then also he was the one that officially ran over to Mark Chapman and took away the gun from him and then said to him, "My God, do you know what you did? You just shot Lennon." And when he said that, Chapman just turned into like a zombie. And I, on my half, believe that these words, "you just shot Lennon," was trigger words. They had these trigger words to activate these Manchurian candidates.
Yeah, so if someone
anyway,
asked
he was just standing there like a zombie waiting to be picked up. And
Yeah, so if someone asked you, you know, how do you know Jose Perdomo was the doorman? Like, where's your evidence for that? Like, how did you get that? That's a really interesting fact that this Cuban emigre who was involved in the JFK assassination turns up posing as the doorman when John Lennon is assassinated. That's fascinating.
But this is you can see that on in the first newspapers, the first articles, the first his name. That's how I found him. And appears, and in all the official stories, if you see also in the documents, it says Jose Perdomo. But the thing is, nobody knew who this Jose Perdomo was until, well, I believe I'm the first, one of the first ones who started understanding where these guys came from and tracking them down, because officially this guy was dead in 74, I think. That's the official story, but he was there that night. And if you look at in the official documents, it says he's a former CIA employee that was working as a doorman that evening. Then he disappears very quickly. It's only in the various clips that he's mentioned. And then after that, he's only referred to as the doorman. And then after that, he just disappears. There's also, if you can hear, you can find on YouTube, I think, there's a video, an interview, just a few minutes after the shooting, and there's this woman saying, "I don't know what happened, but Lennon was, he was arguing with a doorman. He was arguing with a doorman." And, well, judge for yourself. It's like, I think, to say that it's only a coincidence that this highly skilled assassin was there when this was carried out, I think that it would be a bit naive.
So you refer to mind control, and I think this is one aspect, you know, like the mainstream media, you would never get an acknowledgement that methods such as hypnotism and other forms of mind control are utilized by intelligence agencies, are utilized by nefarious political actors in order to set up patsies. And we see this time and time again that these so-called terrorists, these so-called assassins, and other people who get implicated in false flag ops and covert assassinations, they act like crazy people. And it is a dimension that's overlooked. This effort to use science to shape society, society to engage in social engineering. And one way they do that, it seems, is to set up patsies by manipulating their minds. And of course, we see like so much money in North America, especially in academia, goes into psychology and neuroscience. Like the university I attended here in Alberta has this huge neuroscience complex. And well, what's neuroscience? It's the science of the brain, right? So there's a lot of funding goes into studying the brain. And that's not really surprising, right? Because clearly it's very expedient from a commercial point of view and from the perspective of maintaining hierarchy and power to control our brains. And of course, that's the whole point of false flag terrorism, isn't it? They're psychological operations. So we'll go to the break in about 5 minutes from now. But could you just get into like, what is mind control? How is it used as a method? And what is the Tavistock Institute? Words like this, you know, perhaps not all listeners know what the Tavistock Institute is and how mind control is used by the powers that be.
In this area, I'm not an expert, so I prefer not to telling too much. But what I can say from what I know is that I don't think, or very rarely are they used as the assassins themselves. They're used as the patsy because they cannot be trusted to do the killing in a skillful way. But normally they're placed in very near to the hit itself. And then once the shooting is over, they're pointing out, it was that guy, it was that guy. I think Sirhan is a very, very clear example of one of these guys. And also Mark Chapman is another one. You got the shooting in Norway, this guy as well, where they show all the same symptoms of mind control, which is very often afterwards they have absolutely no recollection of what happened, of the crime. They show absolutely no emotions about it. And when they tell the story about what happened, it's like a loop. They will repeat the same words again and again. If you speak to them one time, then you speak to them 6 months later, they will repeat the same story, more or less word by word. And also one of the things that they do is that after the killing, they will just stand waiting there. They will just stand like a zombie until they're picked up. For instance, it was the case with I think maybe you've heard about this mass shooting in Norway where all of these young kids were shot on an island.
Yes, yes. They took out a whole generation of labor workers. Yeah,
there were... officially, it was only one guy, but the witnesses say there was at least two shooters. And one of them were on the mobile with the SWAT team during a whole hour while he was walking around shooting these people. And then when the SWAT team finally arrived, after lots and lots of delay, which is also standard in these when it comes to these conspiracies, that they delay the rescue so that the task is really completed before they move in. When the SWAT team finally arrived to the island, they knew the guy's name, and as soon as they called his name, he just put his gun down right away and just stood waiting to be taken, instead of what you would think. After having killed so many others and really being into the killing, you would think that he would put up a fight or anything like that. But instead, he just went totally paralyzed and like a zombie, put down his gun and just waited.
Yeah, so I think we'll go to the first break now, if that's okay, Ole.
For sure.
Okay, well, I'm pleased to be joined by Ole Damigard of LightOnConspiracies.com, a conspiracy guru, expert on covert assassinations, and connector of dots. We'll be back after the break.
Why don't they leave us alone? Don't be crazy. Thank you.
Even Bush admits that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Our own FBI acknowledged it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to 9/11. But if Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and if Osama had nothing to do with 9/11, then who did it?
Who did it?
The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer. Discover the big picture. Learn what we know now. Find out what it means. 11 experts contribute to exposing the truth as the anatomy of an atrocity. Edited by James H. Fetzer. Buy it now if you have the courage to face the truth. Just don't think you're going to like it. The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer.
Welcome back from the break, ladies and gentlemen. I'm still here with Ole Damagad. We are going to get into more detail about Operation 40. Now, the interesting thing with your investigation into the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, Ole, was the fact that you discovered that the actors who were involved in that assassination were also involved, it seems, in a broader global network with the assassination of JFK, and it turns out with John Lennon and so on. So were you surprised when you were investigating an assassination which on the surface appeared to be specific to Sweden, that it actually had tie-ins and was interwoven with political developments in the United States and in other global countries?
I would be extremely surprised, but this is it's taken me like 30 years to come to these conclusions, so it's not something that went overnight. But so many times I've been sitting like with my jaw and in my knee, sort of like, my God, what is this? Because I had absolutely no idea when I started looking into these things. I had absolutely no idea that they were actually connected in the way they were. And so for sure, it's been a very scary, but also very interesting and I don't know what to call it, the trip over all of these years.
Perhaps not all of the listeners will know about the assassination of Olof Palme. I know you've got into it in a previous show with Professor Fetzer on The Real Deal. But maybe before we go into more detail with what Operation 40 is, you could just encapsulate the assassination of the Prime Minister of Sweden, Olof Palme. Like, when did it happen? How did it happen briefly? And then that will provide some context for explaining how this global network of assassins and false flag experts was formed.
Well, the assassination of Olof Palme is officially a very easy assassination and a very easy crime to solve, even though it took them many, many years. But the official story is that Olof Palme and his wife went to the cinema on the 28th of February 1986. They didn't have bodyguards or anything, and they just wanted an evening out together with their son and his girlfriend, and they went to the cinema. And while they were in the cinema, they were observed by an unknown guy who was later claimed to be a patsy. His name was Christer Pettersson. And anyway, when the cinema ended, they started walking home to the old town in Stockholm. And at a corner on one of the main streets in Stockholm, this guy was standing behind the corner and waiting for them. And when they passed, he just took two steps forward, put his hand on Olof Palme's shoulder and fired one shot right into the back of Palme, killing him instantly. So he went down, and then he fired a second shot at the wife, who was officially the bullet just it went extremely close to her but didn't hit her. And then after that, he just ran off.
His skin and, or something.
Yeah, exactly. He ran off, and that's the last observation of him. Later, a guy was, like I say, he was arrested for the crime 2-3 years later. His name was Christer Pettersson. He was a local alcoholic guy, a perfect patsy. And they pinned him down with this crime, and he was sentenced for it, for the murder of Olof Palme. No motive, no nothing. They say that one of the theories they tried to push forward was that he thought that Olof Palme was his drug dealer because they had the same type of fur hat on. And when he saw him walking down the street, he thought it was his drug dealer, and he was pissed off with him, so he wanted to kill him. So he ran home, got the gun, and went up behind them and shot them. So instead of it being an assassination of a prime minister, it was an execution of a drug dealer. I mean, okay, possibly. But when you look into the evidence, absolutely super lie. I mean, it had nothing to do with what actually was carried out. What did was carried out, according to my research, which is not the same as most other researchers, because today most people in Sweden are still at the stage where they say, was it Christer Pettersson or wasn't it? Just like on a big scale in the States after all of these years, it's still a question. Was it Lee Harvey? Was he alone? Or was there possibly a second shooter? Instead of what the real truth was, that there was a whole team of shooters just bombarding the motorcade from all different direction. And anyway, so it has turned out with this assassination of Olof Palme is as multi-layered as the JFK assassination. It is super complex. And but what I've been able to track down is that what actually took place was a military-type assassination with 3 escape cars, a team of 8 people involved, assassins, shooters, and secondary shooters. If the first one missed, then the other one will take over, with local police involved and with the Swedish government, some of it backing the whole thing, where the murderers, the hit team, was flown in from abroad, consisting of people from different countries, different backgrounds, and so on, so that there was no connecting points between them, and that this assassination was carried out very efficiently and with backup on the highest level, not from Sweden, but internationally. We're talking about the same global elite that are behind the JFK assassination, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Oklahoma City, 9/11, Bob Marley, John Lennon, Che Guevara, Salvador Allende, Paulo Neruda, Ann Olof Palme, Robert Smith in South Africa, Carlos Prats, Orlando Letier in Washington, and so on. It just carries on and on and on and on. This global elite have used their group of assassins so many times and in so many different countries that it's just mind-boggling when once you start looking into it and once you start finding out that it's actually this. They've even used the same assassins. That's the incredible thing. And I heard one interview with one of these guys who had become a whistleblower, and they said, but why on earth do you think they used the same team? And he said, why change a winning team? They're so good at it, why change it? So they use them again and again. And these guys, some of them are still active to this very day. I mean, some of them are still living in Canada and are very, very active. So even though they're...
I better watch out then.
even if they're in the late 70s and so on, some of them are very active.
Yeah, so it seems with Sweden they had a similar problem that they have with Canada, that they can't really have a Western country being neutral and peace-loving and liberal. They have to turn them into a warmongering country. And, you know, certainly I moved to this country, Canada, almost a decade ago, and I've seen this country shift from being a peace-loving liberal society into being one of the most aggressive warmongering, at the moment it's very anti-Iranian regimes on the planet. And would that be one of the incentives behind trying to force Sweden to metamorphose from being this idyllic social democracy, at least that's how those of us outside Sweden have viewed it, into being a more belligerent and pugilistic and aggressive actor on the geopolitical stage?
Do you know, my book is called Coup d'etat in slow motion, and that is truly what I believed happened that night. It was a coup d'etat in slow motion. The reason it's done in slow motion after the shooting had finished was so that people would notice what actually had happened. But if you see now, just like you described Canada, this is what happened in Sweden. They turned from a very soft, very non-violent society into something totally different, where they're now part of the NATO and the whole war scene, pumping out war, weapons through the weapon industry and so on. But Olof Palme was much more than that, because he was also a member of the global elite. He was also a Bilderberger and part of the Committee of 300 and so on. But it came to a point where he suddenly started acting unreliable for the elite, and he caused massive problems. He started stopping arms deliveries. He started becoming like somebody they couldn't trust anymore. So there was a series of meetings in Wiltshire in England, where there were people from NATO and different governments and the military industrial complex and so on. And there was decisions made to take him out on that. But it was even more than that. There was even more than one operation going on at the same time. There were two different operations simultaneously trying to take him out. So it's extremely complex. That's why when I was on Red Eyes Radio, we spent like 8 hours of interviews to go into the details of this, because it's an extremely complex assassination.
And he had HIV. He was HIV positive, wasn't he? And that sort of plays into it. And you postulated that perhaps he in some way was complicit in his own assassination, which sounds kind of outlandish, but when you explain it, it actually seems plausible.
This is, do you know, when I did these Red Eyes interviews, I did first 6 hours really going into the details of what happened and who was involved and all of this. And on the fourth interview, I came forward with this theory, because it is way out there. It's so extreme that most people would just shake their head and say, oh, come on. But if you look at it, at least that this is after all of these years, when I look at this theory, suddenly everything falls into place. All the pieces matches, all suddenly things that are so strange suddenly make sense. So I cannot swear that this is the truth, but I for one truly believe that this is what happened. And also there's more than one high-ranking politician and people on a high level who have stepped forward with very similar theories as well. So
and what's the diagnosis? I really think was the diagnosis accurate? I mean, because I've often wondered whether they may have misdiagnosed him deliberately to make him feel like he was dying anyway, to make him acquiesce to those who wanted to have him in on the plot of his own assassination.
But this what do you say, this HIV positive, it's never been officially confirmed. It's confirmed that he had some kind of virus disease, but never that it was HIV. So this is what I'm putting forward, and other people as well, as a theory, but it's never been officially shown in any way.
Yeah, we've recently seen Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader, exhumed. His body has been exhumed for post-mortem to be conducted on him so they can find out what was in his blood. And it almost seems that if we were going to get to the truth of Olev Palme's assassination, we'd have to exhume his body and do blood tests, you know? But it's very interesting when you've got into this. So you realized as you were investigating the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister that this was actually part of a global phenomenon. You've just thrown out about a dozen names just now. Like you mentioned Robert Smith in South Africa. That piques my interest. Who was Robert Smith in South Africa?
Robert Smith was that assassination is still unsolved officially. And it's one of the biggest murder scandals in South Africa. He and his wife were shot dead in their home. And the people who carried out that was, one of them were Michael Vernon Townley. If I can go back to Operation 40, he was never part of Operation 40, but he was very close to that operation. And if you go back to Dealey Plaza, one of the CIA officers, his name was David Attlee Phillips, if you remember, I mentioned him. He was actually the controller of no one less than Lee Harvey Oswald. He was the guy who groomed him as a patsy. He was the operation chief in Mexico City when they were trying to blame it on Oswald and then through that on Cuba or Russia and so on. But this David Attlee Phillips, who was very central in the assassination of JFK, he was also the CIA controller of James Files, which was the shooter, in my opinion, the shooter behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll. There's many different shooters. I can go through the different ones, but he was the controller of James Files. He was also, like I say, the controller of Michael Vernon Townley, who was a very skilled assassin who is working on an international level and in many, many different countries, one of them being Chile, where he was part of taking out Salvador Allende. He was also part of blowing up Orlando Letier in Washington. I don't know if you remember that. His car was blown up on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C.
No, I don't remember that. That was the
biggest internal, case of terrorism before 9/11. So it was a massive scandal. And people, like the bomb was supplied by a man called Orlando Bosch, who was also at Dealey Plaza and part of Operation 40. That was the guy. There was also another guy, Virgilio Paz, who was sentenced for this crime as well. But the same people, they are not James Files, but the other ones, not Orlando Bosch either, but the other ones were the ones who were carrying out the assassination of Robert Smith in South Africa. This Michael Vernon Townley was also the guy who assassinated, or he killed Nobel Prize winning poet Pablo Neruda in 1973, just after the overtake of Salvador Allende. He was taken to the hospital, and Michael Townley, dressed as a doctor, came in and while he was asleep, gave him an injection in the stomach, and he died very shortly afterwards. This very same Michael Vernon Townley was also present in Stockholm many, many years later when all of Palma was taken out. So coincidence or not, but if you ask me, he was one of the guys driving one of the escape cars. There were three escape cars involved there. But there are other incredible links. You know, like if we go back to Dealey Plaza, do you remember the Umbrella Man?
Yes, Professor Fetzer has authored an article on that. Of course, I wasn't alive when JFK was assassinated, and it wasn't my generation's main covert operation. Obviously, I'm the 9/11 generation. I'm 27 years old. But so I've had to sort of catch up with JFK, but I'm aware of the Umbrella Man. So who was the Umbrella Man, in your opinion?
No, the reason why these assassinations are important, I think, is not because JFK was a president and he was shot. I mean, that is tragic, but it doesn't really matter so much today. Or maybe it does, because in my opinion, the people that took him out, the power elite that took him out, is the same power elite that are still there today, carrying out all of these things and trying to force us into this horrible society, this state of terror. It's the same people that are active today. So that's why it's very important to study history and see where did these people come from, how did they get to where they are today, and so on, to be able to, and also study history, because it has a very clear pattern of repeating itself. So by studying, we can learn what is going on and then stop it, stop what's going on, and create a much, much more beautiful world than the one we are going towards at this moment, because we're at a very extreme point in history, I would say.
Can you explain what you mean by this continuity? Because some of us feel that 9/11 was about a new faction of the elite taking over or supplanting the kind of old guard, that you had these old CIA dudes who had been running the American empire, but that the neoconservatives, that was a Jewish intellectual movement or a Zionist intellectual movement, and this was about these nouveau riche elites ousting the old guard who used to prioritize oil in the Middle East over the interests of Israel. So some of us see that rather than there being a continuity, that there's been the kind of taking over from a new faction of the elite, from these old dudes who were doing all these assassinations. Like, I don't really think it's like Cuban emigres motivating the war on terror. I think it's more likely that you have people who are partisan to Israel who are motivating this war against the Muslim world.
Yeah, for sure. But if you take the upper parts of the elite, it's the same, but underneath it changes. And what we're talking about, it's shark waters. You know, these are very power hungry people with lots of intrigues and conspiracies against each other and so on. I would be very worried if I was part of the elite today, because there are so many internal conflicts and so on as well. So for sure. But when what you can see is that the same key people appears again and again, like the Bush family are one of these families that just, they're there every single time as a red thread that goes through this whole thing. If I go back to the Umbrella Man, it was like when the motorcade went around the corner and the shooting started, he was standing right at the point where the shots started being fired. And in my opinion, this guy, it was a sunny day, there was absolutely no reason for somebody to open an umbrella, but he was there to show the point where everybody should start firing, because they needed to point this, to blame this on one single lone crazy guy. So they couldn't have it that there were being shots being fired for like 20 seconds, because then everybody would know that, my God, there are like 50 people shooting from all over. So they needed everybody to start shooting at the same time. That's why he had the umbrella and he was placed exactly there to say, this is where we shoot. The guy in my... according to my studies, this guy, he was a guy very close to Operation 40 as well. His name was Roy Hargraves, a former mercenary and so-called freedom fighter. But the guy who's standing in front of him was a man, an exiled Cuban as well. His name was Felipe Santiago Vidal, oh my God, my brain just went blank. Anyway, I'm sorry about that.
Don't worry, man. So he was a Cuban emigre by the sounds of things, right? He was Cuban?
Yeah, exact Cuban. But also very close to Operation 40. And he used an alias over many years after Dealey Plaza. His name was Charles Morgan, the name he used. And he was working for the CIA through a company called ITT. And one of his major tasks was to go to different countries and hire new assassins because people on a local basis to be involved when they take out someone. And this guy was in Stockholm trying to get hold of local Swedish assassins in the fall of 1985, which was just a few months before the assassination of Olof Palme. So you got direct links from Dealey Plaza to Stockholm, 1986. And so that is one of the reasons why this group is so important to really look into. Also, there's another guy in Operation 40. His name was Porter Goss, and maybe some of you know recognize this name because he later turned out to be the chief of the CIA, the director of the CIA under George Bush. So these names keeps popping up.
Well, this is certainly very fascinating. I think we're going to go to the second break right now. I'm very grateful for you being with us, Ole. You know, you're an encyclopedia of knowledge, connecting all these dots on a global scale and informing the public about the real developments with these covert assassinations and who's involved. So we'll go to the break now. Thank you.
Weapons for all occasions. And everyone got excited about the technology. And I guess it was pretty incredible watching a missile fly down an air vent. Pretty unbelievable. But couldn't we feasibly use that same technology to shoot food at hungry people?
This one is dedicated to the suit-wearing arms dealers, to the champagne-sipping depleted uranium droppers.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone.
First in my scope is BAE Systems. Specialize in killing people from a distance. Power is a drug and they feed the addiction. Immediate deletion of people's existence. Who says what isn't legitimate resistance. To push these buttons, you don't need a brave heart. State of the art darts leave more than your face scarred. You might impress an A&R with your fake bars. Cause you probably think Rolls Royce only make cars. This is for the colonizers, turn bomb providers. Take this beef all the way back to Oppenheimer. They call it warfare, but your wars aren't fair. If they were, they'd be suicide bombers. In arms fairs, a scam for the funds. They will mangle your son. If you try to speak out, they will stamp on your tongue. To your land they will come. Till you stand up as one, it's begun.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone.
Next in my scope is Lockheed Martin. They will tell you when the bombs need blasting. Don't think, just listen to the songs, keep dancing. Do they really want us to have our own brains? Who do you think is really running Guantanamo Bay? And it might be sensitive, but I'll mention it. Who do you think's got us filling out the censuses? Who do you think is handing out the sentences? This ain't the BBC, so there's no censorship. Heard of many mercenaries getting with the clever pimp. Not a gun seller, but none's better than Eric Prince. Make money off many things, mainly it's crime. This one is dedicated to the Wraith. On a scam for the funds, they will mangle your son. If you try to speak out, they will stamp on your tongue. To your land, they will come. Till you stand up as one, it's begun.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone.
We can now say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Veer Radio is listener supported. We need your donations to pay for live internet streaming radio, our toll-free call-in number, and our website, free MP3 archive links, and interactive forums. Go to ReveerRadioNetwork.com and click on the Make a Donation button.
Hey folks, Rob Revere here. When you think about a beach getaway, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Probably Florida, right? Well, let's take away all the condos, the tourists, and the traffic that Florida has to offer, and what do you have left? Probably the one thing that you went on vacation for and Florida doesn't have to offer. And that's Serenity. Serenity is a beautiful 3-bedroom, 2-bath located in Surfside Beach, Texas. And it's actually one of the premier vacation spots to achieve a relaxing vacation away from it all. Serenity is perfect for small private getaways or family vacations featuring 3 bedrooms and 2 baths with a full kitchen. Not to mention the incredible view from either of the 2 observation decks. So do yourself a favor and head on over to ReveerRadioNetwork.com. Look for Serenity on the left-hand side of the page. Whether it's one night, 2 nights, or a week, you'll be thanking me. Let them know Rob sent you.
So welcome back from the break. I'm joined by Ole Damagard still from LightOnConspiracies.com. We're embarking on the third segment where Ole is going to continue deconstructing this rather nefarious grouping called Operation 40. As we go through these different assassinations, Ole, it would be useful, I think, if you explained what the incentives were for taking out the respective victims of these assassinations. Obviously, you've mentioned the incentives for taking out JFK, the incentives for taking out Olev Palme. You mentioned briefly Sirhan earlier. Now, he was involved in taking out RFK. So perhaps at some point you could mention what were the incentives for removing the obstacle of Robert Kennedy. If you could, you can pick up where you left off deconstructing Operation 40.
Okay, first I just wanted to say the name I couldn't remember was Felipe Vidal Santiago. That's the guy who is, he's the guy that he's called the waving guy. He stands in front of the umbrella man in Dealey Plaza. And he was the guy who was later in Stockholm, just a few months before the assassination of Palme, trying to hire Swedish assassins to get involved in the assassination. When it comes to the reason why they had killed these people or the victims, mostly either the victims are people from the same group. I mean, I'm not talking about the same group of assassins, but parts of the global elite, people that have become untrustworthy or doesn't fit in anymore, who've been big-headed, become big-headed and starting to go their own way or something like that. These are the people they take out. And one of the reasons why, for instance, JFK was killed open daylight, right in front of cameras and lots of people and so on, is, in my opinion, because it had been so easy for them to just drop a pill in his coffee or something like that and get rid of him, if that was the only reason they wanted him out. But they also wanted to statue an example to inflict fear in the corridors of power, to show everyone that we can take out anyone at any time, anywhere, so you just back off and keep your mouth shut. So when you see these assassinations, especially when they're out in the open like this, almost always there's almost like a second conspiracy of silence that follows, that people in so-called power, they go totally quiet, except when it comes to the official story pointing at the Patsy. Then that's the one they're backing up, pointing at the Patsy, pointing at the Patsy, pointing at the Patsy. Even though most of them, even though they don't know how the assassination maybe were carried out in detail, they sure know the power behind it, and they know that they could very well be the next on the list if they didn't keep quiet.
Yes, yes. So the idea is to, you know, send a message to future people, even like someone like Barack Obama today. You know, I've heard the phrase before that the worst kind of tyranny is a democratic tyranny, because all your fellow citizens or subjects believe that the prime minister and the so-called elected politicians are the people who actually hold power. And I think one of the important things that people like ourselves who look into these conspiracies need to emphasize is that we need to critique primarily the puppet masters rather than the puppets, right? And the politicians, the people who we're encouraged to criticize, you know, our media gets to look very democratic because they're constantly criticizing and scrutinizing the politicians. But those guys are quite low down in the pecking order, aren't they? And you referred earlier to the fact that, you know, what was going on with the factionalism among the U.S. elite, that that's only one strata, and that there's higher strata in the hierarchy that where we can look at the real puppet masters. And do you think that's important that we explain that to the public?
Yeah, for sure. But like I say, this is not an area that I've specialized in, because I left that to other people who are more have more knowledge in those that area. But for sure, I would say that very few presidents are really the ones making the real choices. I mean, one of the people who have really been involved in this whole thing is George Bush Sr. He's deeply involved in it and also part of the group where decisions are taken. But many of the other ones have just been absolute puppets, put there as a nice front cover as a puppet in front of this massive war machine who's just been moving forward. That's also why there's never any change after an election. It's this, whoever you choose, it's just different arms from the same body. So there's no change, and this is also one reason, I think, that when you make an assassination like this, that the puppet in front, he knows that he really needs to stay in line, otherwise he will be next. But I think that when you look back in history, I truly believe that JFK was the last real elected president. I believe that the whole row of presidents ever since that have been part of the same elite that killed him. It was a coup d'etat, a brutal murder of JFK. And after that, the people who have followed comes from the same that actually killed him. Can you can track down. I mean, it started very early, like Johnson, who was deeply involved in the assassination, Lyndon Johnson. Then you had Gerald Ford, who was in the Warren Commission. You had Richard Nixon, who was in charge of Operation 40, that was deeply involved in the assassination, who took over after that. And then you have Bill Clinton, who was deeply involved in the Iran-Contra scandal with all this drugs coming into the country. And so on. It's just moved on and on and on. George Bush Jr., John Bush Sr., and so on. And now Barack Obama, who, in my opinion, is in one way the worst of them all, because he's so likable. He's the perfect front person. You just want to like him. You just want to trust what he's saying. But if you look at what's going on behind the scenes, it's the worst ever, absolute worst ever. So,
why do you think this might be a tangent, but why do you think Fidel Castro survived? Because I know that a lot of those Cuban emigres who did the job on JFK had been training to take out Fidel. He used to do a weekly drive from Havana to Varadero, I think, in an open-top vehicle, and I gather they had been trained to take out Fidel. You know, so we've obviously referred to the people who were taken out, but then the question that arises from that is why were other people who have been controversial, who have seemingly deviated from the prescribed role given to them from the powers that be, what, like Fidel would, you know, personify that deviance, and why do you think he wasn't taken out?
They really tried for a while, but I think down the line it just became uninteresting. I mean, they had Cuba totally, isolated and so on. He wasn't really a threat anymore. So, but I don't know. I don't know. I just know that there was a lot of people that wanted to see him dead, and they tried several times, but they never succeeded.
Okay.
I can't answer that question, since I'm not the one who was trying to kill him.
Because I went to Havana a few years ago, and Raul Castro was speaking very close to where I was, and he was just standing, in, you know, open in public in the Plaza de Revolucion in Havana. And I was just wondering, you know, why they sort of somehow have managed to evade these assassins. So you wanted to take this in the direction sort of which is it related to Cuba, with Che Guevara's assassination by Felix Rodriguez, if I'm not mistaken. He was the main actor.
Felix Rodriguez was also a member of the Operation 40. He was the right hand of George Bush Sr., and he was very, very deeply involved in the Iran's Contra scandal, and with the weapons being smuggled out of the States from the National Guard down to the Contras army in Nicaragua, and then the planes were filled up with drugs down there and then flown back. One of the main pilots in this transport in and out of these tons and tons and tons of drugs were a man called by the name of Barry Seals, who was also a member of Operation 40, who was one of the people flying some of the hitmen to Dallas this day of the assassination of JFK. And he was later involved in many of these things also. One of the airstrips they used to fly all these drugs in was to a small airstrip in the state of Arkansas, to a small little village called or town called Mena in Arkansas. And at that specific time, the governor of the state was a certain Bill Clinton, who was a very low, unknown person at that time, but who, when he, together with his companion Dan Lasseter, got involved in this drug trading, together with George Bush Sr., that was the thing that started the whole crack epidemia and cocaine thing in the States. That was, the whole idea was to destabilize the American society by pumping in drugs, and so that the minority would start killing themselves, you know, shooting each other, and by pumping in more and more weapons and get the whole crime rates up, to destabilize societies. So Bill Clinton comes from being a very advanced drug smuggler, and then he was invited to one of the Bilderberg meetings where they saw that he had a great potential because he was good on the screen in media and so on, and he was seemed like a nice person that people would trust and so on. And from then on, his career just skyrocketed, and he was elected president within a few years after that.
There was some theories that the Monica Lewinsky incident was an Israeli operation, because Clinton had sought to impose a two-state solution on the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I know there have been statements even from people like Benjamin Netanyahu that the Monica Lewinsky imbroglio sort of saved his bacon. Is there any truth to that?
I'm the wrong person to know. I wouldn't know. What I do feel strongly, though, is that that was one of the methods they use for diversion. You know, when there's a big scandal about to explode, they need something different to divert the attention of the population in a different direction. And if you remember, this ridiculous court thing, or this whole Monica Lewinsky thing, it was going on for months and months and months, keeping people occupied, looking the other way, while the whole Iran-Contra thing was going on in the background and all of these things. So I think, I don't know about the Israeli involvement, but I do think that it was, I think that Clinton was very aware of it to start with, that he really needed to bring forward a scandal big enough to divert the attention away, because otherwise he knew he was going down with the Iran-Contra one. In the meantime, when this whole Monica Lewinsky thing was going on, they changed the airstrips, they changed the airports, they changed the destinations and all of these things, because it was coming up and being uncovered. So that's why they tried to stop it. When it comes to Bill Clinton, I just wanted to mention also that if you remember Oklahoma City, After the first bombs had gone off, lots of people came to the place, and I mean there were dead bodies everywhere, and there were people lying screaming in the rubble and so on. So everybody went there to try and save them. But then there was a warning called out saying there's secondary explosives here. You need to back off. You need to back off. So everybody left the area, and in came two vans. With lots of people in blue overalls that went straight into the rubble. And what they looked for, they didn't care about the people who were lying there dying. What they did, they went straight for office, file cabinets and so on that were in the rubble. They got hold of those, filled the vans, and left. And these cabinets, or the papers that was taken away from the crime scene right there, because it was first when these vans had left that the people could return and start saving whoever could be saved there. These file cabinets were filled with documents from MENA in Arkansas. They had just been transported there a week earlier or something like that. And these files were involving Bill and Hillary Clinton in the so-called White River scandal. It was a big scandal about real estate fraud and so on, where Bill and Hillary were involved. And so when you track down this dear Mr. Clinton, there's a lot that it smells a lot, and there's many, many suicides and assassinations following him and Hillary. So it's important to understand that when you look at these people that looks really nice on TV and nice suits and all of these things and look very charming, when you track them down, you will see that there's many of them are super criminal, super, super criminal. So it's a strange world to wake up to.
I remember when Bill Clinton's memoir or like autobiography came out, there were really intelligent people who I knew who were coming up to me and saying, oh, you should read this biography. Bill Clinton's such a nice guy. Or even people who self-identified as right-wing people, you know. So I think there's been a big public relations campaign for all these leaders to try and make them appear like good guys, men of the people and so on, when really they're gangsters, as you're suggesting.
Super gangsters. I mean, if you look at the Bush family, George Bush Sr., I mean, he makes Hitler look like a schoolboy. I tell you, when you look at it, it's just absolutely mind-blowing what this family has been involved in. And that's just one part of the whole global elite. I mean, they're so much bigger. But it's incredible, absolutely incredible.
Yes. So you've mentioned many of the people that Operation 40 took out. So we've touched on Che Guevara, but there were also musicians. We mentioned the Beatles, but Bob Marley, if I'm not mistaken, we're around the anniversary of his assassination currently.
But the thing is with Bob Marley, he officially died from cancer. You know, so most people are not aware of that he was actually murdered. So, but what happened was that Bob Marley is also wrongly looked upon as being somebody who is just smoking dope and sitting in a corner saying Rastafari man. That is absolutely not true. And that is also why he was taken out, because he was a very, very, very brave and strong man, I tell you, who was becoming a big, big international symbol for the whole African continent and for black people, standing up also among his many, most of his followers were white as well. So he was standing up against the military industrial complex. He was standing up saying, fight for your rights, stand up, you know, all of these things, and unite against this elite.
Do you think originally he was like the Beatles? He was kind of set up to encourage people to smoke weed and drop out, but that he deviated from the path again? Because, you know, there's one line in one of his songs where he says, "Have no fear for atomic energy." And I remember my professor and I were talking about this, and we were wondering whether the nuclear industry had sort of paid him to say, "Have no fear for atomic energy." Because obviously, post Fukushima and post Chernobyl, we now know that atomic energy should be feared. So do you think originally he was sent in to sort of encourage white Western kids, like in countries like Britain, where he was very popular, to drop out and smoke weed, just as the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, was encouraging people to imbibe marijuana? But that eventually, like John Lennon and others, he began forming a political consciousness and writing songs, like you say, that were encouraging people to decolonize, encouraging people to unite.
No, I don't think that at all. I think he had a white father and a black mother, and he was sort of like an outcast on Jamaica as well. And that made him have a hard childhood, but made him grow up like a very strong young man, you know, because he was just standing for who he was, even though nobody wanted him to start with. Then when he joined, he got this band together and he really started moving upwards. And he became like a symbol after a while, first having been an outcast, and then he became like a uniting symbol on Jamaica. And for the unity of people, he really stood up and wanted every point. It's like he said, "I'm a simple man with a very simple wish. I just want to unite mankind." And that was what he went for. And no matter what, he was standing up for it. And in 1975, the states were having lots of problems with Jamaica. They wanted, they did not want Jamaica to become a free state and do whatever they wanted. So Henry Kissinger, who's one of the warmongers that is always sent out from the elite, who used to be Lord Carrington, these were the two people who were sent out to different areas as peacemakers, they were officially called, but what they did was that they went into an area and just got the whole conflict stirring up. And so you will find Kissinger in so many different areas that later turn into war zones or coup d'etats or whatever. Henry Kissinger was there before. And in 75, Kissinger went to Jamaica. And after that, he brought with him CIA operatives and so on. And they started like a almost like a sabotage, what would you call it? They went into a series of assassination attempts, of sabotage and all of these things. And in 76... there was all this chaos going on Jamaica, and Bob Marley was asked to perform at a concert that was made there. I think it was called the Sunshine Concert, where they wanted to unite the whole thing. And he said yes. He didn't know that he was being used from one of the sides in this conflict, one of the political parties. But he decided to be part of this concert to unite Jamaica. And just a few days before the concert, there were people breaking into his house with automatic weapons and fired at him. He was wounded. He was almost hit in the chest, but instead the bullet just grasped him and hit in his arm instead. His wife, who tried to cover their kids, was hit in the head from behind. And his manager was, I think he was hit like 4 or 5 times, and because he was trying to protect Bob. But almost by a miracle, he survived this thing. I tried to track down who were the actual shooters, and I know for sure that they're connected to the CIA, but I never managed to get the real identity of the actual shooter of Bob Marley in that event. But anyway, after that, Bob Marley, even though everybody said that if you go to this concert, they will have, you know, snipers, they will take you out on stage and so on, he said, I'm going. So he stood up and he went through this concert wounded and so on, but he did the whole concert, and he got both of the leaders of the two the two parties that were struggling. He got both of them up on stage and made them shake hands in front of all these thousands of people, even though he was under this death threat. So
the CIA had been giving arms to both sides, hadn't they, in Jamaica? And
yeah, that's the standard thing, to get this whole conflict going. But what happened about a week or 10 days after this concert, Bob Marley was approached by a documentary filmer by the name of Carl Colby. Carl Colby is the son of the former director, Bill Colby, who was involved in so many of awful things on this globe as well. Everything from Operation Orange in Vietnam to super many assassinations and the building up of Stay Behind Gladio in Europe and so on. And so the son of this Bill Colby, the CIA director, he came and approached Bob Marley as a film director, talking about making a documentary. And I don't think that Bob was aware of that he was the son of the CIA director. So anyway, they met and they had a nice time. And then Carl Colby brought a present. And this present was a pair of boots, a pair of cowboy boots. So Bob, who really liked jeans and boots and so on, so he was really happy. But when he pulled on one of the boots, the witnesses that were there, they said that he just shouted, you know, "Ow, what was that?" So he pulled it off again, and there was a little piece of copper wire inside one of the boots. Wow. And that had punctured his big toe. And anyway, so they pulled out this copper wire and threw it away and didn't really think more of it. But afterwards, that toe just got worse and worse and worse. And a year or so later, when he was playing football, somebody by accident stepped on this toe. And it just, I wouldn't say exploded, but it just went all poof like this. So he went to the doctor, and by then the cancer was already there.
Wow.
And it had started spreading in the body. And they said, "Please, we need to amputate this toe. We need to." But Bob just totally refused, because like music and dance was his life. And he said, "You know, people without a big toe cannot dance. So I'm going to beat this in a different way."
Yeah, well, we're just at the point of the third break, unfortunately. And of course, just across the Caribbean Sea in Venezuela, it has been alleged that Comandante Hugo Chavez was given a cancer shot by some nefarious actors to punish him for his political positions. But we'll have to pick this up after the break.
Until the philosophy which old one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war. Bet until they're no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation. Until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes. Miss a war. That until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race. And it's a war. That until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war. War. And until the ignoble and unhappy regime that holds our brothers in Angola, in Mozambique, South Africa, subhuman bondage, have been toppled, totally destroyed. Well, everywhere is war. War in the east, war in the west, war up north, war down south, war, war, rumors of a war, and until that day, the African continent will not know peace. We Africans will fight, we find it necessary, and we know we shall win, as we are confident in the victory of good over evil, good over evil.
Stem cell research, abortion, cloning, evolution, creation science, intelligent design. These are hot button issues today. Religion and science, morality and government, corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darwin. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin, at Amazon.com and the major bookstores. Render Unto Darwin.
Sick and tired of him. Sick and tired of rearing lines by seasick, narrow-minded children, hypocrite. All I want is the truth.
We should change the head, tell me some truth.
I've had enough of reading lines by some sit down, unsighted politician. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome back to the fourth and final segment of this episode of The Real Deal. Prior to the break, Ole Damagard was explaining for us the perceived assassination or murder of the reggae legend and icon Bob Marley. So would you like to pick up where you left off, Ole?
Yeah, for sure. We just came to that he had received these pair of boots from the son of Bill Colby, the director of the CIA, and that there was this little copper wire that it seems like there was some kind of poison on it, that cancergenic thing that started causing this cancer growth in his big toe. Because I don't know about you, but I've never heard about anyone getting cancer in a big toe, but that was where it all started. Mm. When it comes to the shooters that attacked Bob Marley just a week before, one of the people that CIA sent down there was a man by the name of Luis Posada Carriles. He was also called El Bambi. This guy is like a key figure in the Iran-Contra scandal. He was working alongside Felix Rodriguez that we spoke about before in the Iran-Contra. So he was also present in Dealey Plaza, and he was part of an assassination attempt on Fidel Castro in Panama in the year 2000.
Yeah.
He's been referred to as one of the most dangerous terrorists in recent history.
He's done operations in Havana too, right?
Yeah, he's all over the place. And he was one of the people sent to Jamaica just before the assassination attempt. So I would put keep it very likely that he was involved in the attempt on Bob Marley. This is also one of the key members in Operation 40. So once again, here's one of these guys. Anyway,
That was Posada, right? That you said.
Yeah,
he's very famous as one of the most
most
angry Cuban emigres. So, what was the mentality of these Cuban emigres? You could just explain that they were very angry, weren't they? They felt, especially with JFK, that they'd been betrayed by so many people in trying to take back Cuba for their class that had been ousted by the Cuban Revolution, and so they had this sense of injustice that they felt they were kind of freedom fighters, didn't they?
Yeah, they saw and see themselves as freedom fighters, but when you look at their acts, I mean, they're the real terrorists, I would say, because I mean, how can you call it being a freedom fighter, like blowing up a passenger plane, killing loads and loads of innocent people, just because it's a pro-Cuban company? I don't call that freedom fighting. I call that terrorism. But they were very, very angry, like you say, when it came to JFK, because they accused him of the Bay of Pig fiasco where JFK had said that he would back them up with air support and so. And then when they tried to invade Cuba, when the air support was needed, officially JFK was the one who stopped it. So the planes never came, and they were left on their own, and they were killed. Many, many hundreds of them were killed and tortured and so on, and they never forgave JFK for that. It has been said that JFK was actually not the one doing it, that it was done by other people, and then JFK had to take the blame for it, to stand up and take responsibility for it, but that he was not actually the one doing it.
But, So we're into sort of the last 20 minutes of the show. So are there any other undertakings of Operation 40 that you think ought to be emphasized, just to hit home the extent of their scope and the magnitude of their influence on the world?
It's just that Operation 40 is important because they're the ones that carried it out. But like you say, with the elite and so on and the structure, they're not the guilty ones in one way, because they're not the ones who have ordered these hits. They're just mechanics doing a job. You know, they have no emotions involved. They're just plain killers that are sent to do a job. Often they don't even know the victim. They don't know why he's killed. They're just there to do a job, and they do it brilliantly. So I just want to mention again, we talked about Carl Colby, the son of Bill Colby, who's still, as far as I know, a film director doing different documentaries and so on. But he was also a witness in the O.J. Simpson trial. Once again, we have all these so-called coincidences, you see, but when people like that pop up again and again and again in some of the most important assassinations in the history of modern times, You have to put a question mark to the side of them, just, you know, like asking, could it be more than a coincidence? And Carl Colby was the neighbor of Nicole, what's her name, Nicole Smith? No, not Smith, the O.J. Simpson's wife. And both he and his wife were giving testimonies about what had been going on and against O.J. Simpson and so on. I just think it's worth mentioning that he was part of that crime story as well.
Well, so it's really interesting, like you say, these individuals pop up at different moments in history, and then we're all supposed to be coincidence theorists, aren't we, from the perspective of those in power, that we're supposed to believe that all these things are just coincidental rather than the product of agency, the product of a conspiracy.
I tell you, it's like when these operations are carried out, they're carried out with what they call a need-to-know chain, that you're only informed about your little part of the whole thing. You're never informed about the whole picture, about what it's all about and so on. So this is one of the reasons also that when people say, but why haven't we heard about this before? And if anyone knew, they would step forward. They only know their little part, and it's very made, you know, compartmentalized on purpose like that, so that no one can go out and give the whole scene, the whole picture. And but more and more evidence are coming forward all the time about what has been going on for such a long time. And I just think it's really important, and that's why I put myself in this position as well, to reveal, to expose what these people are doing to the rest of us. At the same time, I feel that I am extremely positive when it comes to the future, because this group that we're talking about, it's only like a few thousand people in total, and we are like 7 billion or more. So it's an absolute joke that we're letting them control us. We should just, stop being part of the whole game and stop it. This is the whole thing I think is important, is to stop this madness that is going on, so that we can create the world and make it into this beautiful place it's supposed to be. Because this group, I would say, are behind so much of the so-called awful things that are going on at the moment. It's the same group behind so many different things and in so many different areas of life, when it comes to food, water, film, media, assassination, politics. You track it back and you will find it's the same people behind it.
The justification for all these assassinations, of course, was the Cold War, but then the Soviet Union was dismantled in the early 1990s, and that sort of removed the enemy. And so we had this prospect, you know, the possibility of peace in the world, and there was no justification, it seemed, for these operations. You know, perhaps the CIA during the Cold War could have sold it to the people. Yes, we took out JFK, but he was soft on communism, and some people might have gone along with that. But things have actually got worse in recent years since 9/11. Like, we never saw false flag terrorism with such audacity and on such a scale as we've seen in recent years, from 9/11 to 7/7. Some people even look at Fukushima as being a false flag. Recently in Britain, we had the beheading of a soldier in Woolwich. In Canada here, we have constantly, you know, the police come on television and say, oh, we've foiled a terror plot. The other day they came on the TV and said, oh, Al-Qaeda in Iran. You think of that name, Al-Qaeda in Iran, were intending to derail a train in Canada, and we've saved you from a terrorist attack. So we're living through a strategy of tension, aren't we?
That's the whole point. And I tell you, after all of these years, I have not come across a real terrorist. I'm not even sure there is such a thing. Because when you track it down, it doesn't matter what terror act or explosion or civil war or whatever, when you go back into it and really try to dig into the evidence, it turns out it goes back to the same group of people, the same. And you were talking about the Cold War. I mean, after that ended, they really were in a bad state, because they needed the boogeyman to be able to push their agenda forward. Because just like you say, the world was suddenly a peaceful place. And there's a lot of evidence showing that the Cold War was also a stage thing, just to be able to push the world the way they wanted it. And after the Cold War, I mean, in the old days when the Cold War, the boogeyman was a Russian or East German agent or so on. But then after that, they had to find a new one. So they aimed at the Muslims. And the reason why they went for the Muslims was that they're perfect in media. They're dark. They have often names like Muhammad, Akbar, Abdul, things like that that can sound scary for Western European people and so on. And then they started pumping and filling up our minds with that Islam equals terrorism, that if you're a Muslim equals you're a terrorist. This is just brainwashing. We've been pumped with this, and it's absolutely not true. It's really not true at all. And when you look into all of these acts, and also like this Al-Qaeda, which is actually the name of the database, the CIA database of the agents that they have trained. That's what Al-Qaeda means, database. And it's their database. They created it. So they created the enemy that we're now supposed to believe that are dangerous to us. No, it's the creators that are the dangerous ones. So it's a big, it's like a theater play being played out in front of us, trying to scare us into control, so that they can control and push on us whatever they want. But it's I would say there's absolutely no truth to many of these things that we're being pumped with.
And some perceive that, whether it's in Europe or in the Middle East, that the powers that be want to balkanize segregate and divide and rule all of us and break down countries into different confessional groups. We see, not just in the Middle East, but we could go in the Middle East with Syria, where you see Israel and the U.S. sending in these sectarian groups. Because obviously a country like Syria, it's potentially highly fissiparious and highly prone to sectarianism. But the president was uniting the country, and the Ba'ath Party has been uniting the country, and it seems they don't want prosperous United States in the Middle East, you know, that have modern armies, and they can deal with different ragtag confessional groups armed with Kalashnikovs fighting each other, and they can control them easily, but they don't want modern states. But even in Europe, like you see right now in Spain, where you reside, there's a secessionist movement in Catalonia. In the UK, like my country of origin is going to probably cease to exist soon, because Scotland is going to secede from the United Kingdom. So there is a perception that perhaps it started in the Middle East. Some people have drawn attention to a famous or notorious document, the Oded Yinon plan, which was an Israeli plan in the 1980s to balkanize the Middle East so Israel can rule the roost and be hegemonic in the Middle East. But some have perceived that that's happening on like a global scale. The Prime Minister of Canada has made statements, for example, that here in Alberta, where they have the third largest oil reserves in the world, he said we should have a firewall around Alberta. In other words, almost like this part of Canada should secede because in his view, it gets ripped off for taxes by the country. Some have said that in Argentina, in Patagonia, there's all these Israelis turning up there, and there's a theory that Patagonia is going to secede from Argentina. So we also see there's an incentive, it seems, to build up these terrorist groups and these confessional groups and sectarian groups to divide us all, and potentially to divide modern states, because the whole idea of modern states was to encourage prosperity and unity. But that's like bad if you're a globalist or if you're a global hegemon who wants to control the world, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's they do not want unity. They do not want happiness. They do not want solidarity. They don't want countries that can thrive on their own. They want control. They want to destroy and control. And I think it's very important to, when you see the global agenda from this group, it's very important to see that it's not a matter of countries like Sweden does this and England does that and this and the US do this. And then you have to look at least on the level of the Bilderbergers, the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission to see how these networks are connected, how people, this is also why right after 9/11, I mean, the buildings were not even, the dust hadn't even settled before they started to talk about the war on terror, let's go for that. And within minutes, Tony Blair on the other side of the Atlantic joined. And then after that, I think it was the French prime minister, he joined as well, and then the Swedish prime minister joined as well. How? And it was within half an hour, this unity on the war on terror, which means absolutely nothing. Who are you fighting? I mean, it's like, what are you even talking about? But it's when you see that these people are part of the same groups, the same, like very often in the Bilderberg group, you can see the members, they look like they're divided, but behind the scene, they're the same little group, the same little joint. So when you say US and Israel, you have to look at it on a higher level where they're actually connected. If you say Tony Blair and George Bush, you have to see it on a higher level and see that they're actually, you know, the same unit behind the scenes. So it is, you know, it's a matter of they want to destroy society. They want to destroy the world as we know it. They want to destroy us as people, and they want to destroy nations to get maximum control over us so that they can start building the Fourth Reich, actually, the New World Order, out of the ruins and get us into this dark and awful and controlled place where, well, at least I don't want to live there for sure. That's one thing there.
Do you think they want to depopulate us too? I've heard some theories that, you know, the ultimate goal is to drag the U.S. by its nose into these wars in the Middle East, but eventually that will ruin the U.S. But the ultimate goal is to pit the U.S., Russia, and China against each other. We'll probably have a nuclear holocaust, which will reduce the global population to, say, like 2 billion people, which will be far easier for this New World Order to control than 6 or 7 billion.
I've heard it many times. If it's true or not, I do not. But when you look at how the way they use the vaccines, the swine flu vaccines to start depopulate and how they do in the third world countries and with chemtrails and you know, GMOs. And I mean, what can you think? It's like they don't want the best for us, that's for sure. So, but we are in extreme times, but I think very exciting times as well, because it is coming to a point where the dark and the light, you know, are meeting, and I'm a true believer in that the light will conquer, you know. It's just, and I also think that there's strong signs that this elite are getting very, very anxious, you know, and they're trying to speed things up with all these mass shootings and so on, staged events, once again, false flags, to dearm the population so that they can take over quicker. And I think many signs that showing that it's falling apart from them. More and more people are waking up to see what's actually going on. And so I think it's just a matter of time before it's over for them. And but like I said before, and many times before, I'm not here to spread fear or hate or anger or anything of it. I'm totally for compassion and forgiveness and these beautiful things. But first of all, we need transparency. We need to see what's going on. We need people like in the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa, where there were awful, awful things had been committed, but where they found out that the only way we can move forward is by transparency, by people admitting what had been happening, what had been going down, how these things happened. And then on the other side, we can start heal, because it's a very painful process, but it's necessary. It's like a cancer growth, and we need to expose this cancer. Otherwise, it will kill the body, you know. So, and this is, so I think this is one of the reasons why I'm here at frontline, trying to do my absolute utmost in exposing these things, because it's not without risks, and but I'm doing it, and I'm happy to do it. But
yeah, you did experience some pushback against your research when you were living in Scandinavia. You don't live there anymore because of your research into the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's like we were a small group of people, and two of my friends were murdered, and I had a visit in my home when I was not there. Very scary. I mean, because these people, they deal with problems in a very violent way, and if you're in their way, they just get rid of you, and very simple. And this is also the reason why I chose to leave Sweden and move here. Because I felt I'm not going to live that much longer if I stay, so I decided to move and finish the book, and now it's being published here after all of these years in the States. So, it is a scary, scary road to walk down, but it's important.
So how did your friends die, if you don't mind me asking?
One of them had one of these strange cancers, he went to a checkup, and he came out with this cancer that killed him very, very quickly. And the other guy was, he was found in the subway with his skull crashed. And then he was taken to hospital, and he was recovering. And just when he was recovering, they decided to move him to another hospital that was a lot less equipped for this thing. And then complications got involved, and he died after that. One of the reasons I know that it was actually an assassination was that it took I think it was almost 2 years to get his autopsy protocol public, and in that it's very clear from the way the statements are written that he was actually hit really with a violent heavy metal piece in the back of his head, and some researchers have looked into this case, and they say that he was actually taken out in the hospital. And if you look, this is not just one case. When you go into this world of conspiracies, it's quite common that people are taken into hospital for some kind of thing, and then when they're there or they have a normal operation or something like that, suddenly these complications enters, and boom, they're dead. This is by the hundreds when you look into it. So what can I say? One of a high-ranking police officer was the one who labored these murders, both of these murders, and he was a guy who did not say these things easily. He's dead now as well, so there's a lot of people who have died around these things. Lots and lots and lots.
We have a couple of minutes left. I recently watched that movie, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is set in Sweden, and it was interesting because it addresses a conspiracy among the elite, it's kind of a mainstream movie. Have you seen that film, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo? Because it almost is a movie depiction of the kind of thing you're talking about, but yet it doesn't really point in the same direction that you're pointing, so I thought it might be some kind of decoy or red herring that they've produced.
No, you know, the author of that these books, he's world famous now, but he died very mysteriously as well. I think it was of a heart attack, but he was only like 52 as far as I remember, and he was digging very deeply into what was going on in Sweden in the right-wing coalitions and the connections into the government and all of this into the global elite and so on. So he was digging deep into that, and then he died like many others. If it was natural or caused, I do not know. But like you say, this story as well is one of these things pointing in that direction.
Okay, well, I think on that note, we'll wrap things up. It's been an exhilarating 4 25-minute segments that we've done today, Ole. I've really enjoyed our discussion. As I say, you're an encyclopedia, a wealth of knowledge that you bring to us, just as people were thinking that perhaps Jim Fetzer was the world's expert on false flag terrorism and covert ops. Along came Ole Damgaard to give him a run for his money. You're really one of the world's experts on these important subjects. And all I can do is advise the listenership to go to your website, Light on Conspiracies, and if they have a few spare dollars, to consider donating to you and to your research, because I know that you've undertaken this research at great expense to yourself. So do you want to just tell us if there's any other websites or what's the title of your book just before we finish things?
The title is Coup d'etat in slow motion, and I normally end these programs because I've been on many, many shows, but since it's very important for me not to spread hate or all of these negative feelings, but it's very important for me to lift with the knowledge, you know, not to inspire violence or anything. And I have a very close friend, a yoga teacher of mine, who she has this beautiful prayer that she normally ends with, and it goes like this: May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who hurt us, be filled with peace and love, peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light. And this is the thing. I think, you know, when you look at history and you see when people have taken over with revolutions and so on, violent revolutions, within a year or two after they've taken over, they are worse than the people who were in power before. And so violence is not the way to go. It is absolutely not the way to go. It's the Mahatma Gandhi way, the way Martin Luther King was talking about as well. We need to become brothers and sisters and unite and stop this madness, and not by killing or you know, chopping these people up and into small pieces and serving them as bolognese. That is not the way to go. The way forward is transparency and compassion and forgiveness. That is what I believe in, even though it will be very painful on the way, but this is the way. And I think the native Indians, they say that we, the people who are living now, we are the strongest of the strong. These souls that are here now are the strongest of the strong, and we are fighting a battle now between darkness and light. And our ancestors have chosen us to come to Earth at this time, to go through this time and go through these experiences. So it's actually a super, super time to be alive. No time to go around and being depressed and hang with your head and say, ooh, gloomy, doomy. This is the time to stand up in truth and compassion and change this world into this beautiful place it's supposed to be.
And on that note, I think we're going to have to wrap things up, Ole, because we've run out of time. But I thank you again, Ole Damegard, Light on Conspiracies.com. People can Google that. And hopefully, if you have a few spare dollars, please donate to help Ole continue his research while also putting food on the table for his family. Thank you very much, Ole Damegard.
Thank you, Joshua. It's been an absolute pleasure.
All my trouble seems so far away. Now it looks as though we're here to stay. I believe in yesterday.